Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Dr. Martin Luther King Day, Monday, the 17th of January. It's All Things Political for the first hour of our program today. Hour number two, we'll be talking about end-of-life issues. The first hour, our guest is Bill Schneider. He's a member of the CNN political team that won an Emmy for its 2006 election coverage and a Peabody for its 2008 coverage. He has been called the Aristotle of American politics and also one of the most consistently intelligent analysts on television. He is also distinguished senior fellow and resident scholar at Third Way, and he's a professor of public policy at George Mason University in Washington, D.C. We'll be welcoming your phone call as we talk about the political issues of the day. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, it is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Bill. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Let's start with Dr. Martin Luther King. From 1958, men often hate each other because they fear each other. They fear each other because they don't know each other. They don't know each other because they cannot communicate. They cannot communicate because they are separated. Seems an appropriate reflection for this time in which we live.
Yes, it does. And while there's been huge progress, of course, I grew up in the South in the 1950s, and I grew up under segregation. Young people today don't remember what it was like. In fact, they find it unbelievable that the races were held by law separate in those days. So we've come an awful long way, but there are still very, very serious problems. I think less problems of legal or overt discrimination as inequality, and those problems have yet to be solved. And a lot of the separation has to do with the newer immigrants, the resentment of illegal immigrants, the whole new face of America out there.
Mm-hmm. And it's an issue that we haven't really taken on. Wait till we hit that one, huh?
Oh, yeah. It's going to be very complicated and very difficult. It's already an issue that's produced violence. It's an issue that's produced enormous tension, even especially in parts of the country that aren't used to seeing immigrants, places like Iowa and Georgia, and not just border states. This is changing the face of America everywhere.
When do you think Congress will take on this issue, Bill?
Not quickly, because there is a constituency out there that essentially sees the whole immigration issue as one of law enforcement and crime, and they won't tolerate anything that looks like giving amnesty to people who have committed a crime, who have entered the country illegally. Americans understand the nature of this problem. The polls all indicate that people, on the whole, favor a path to citizenship if the people who have entered this country illegally pay a fine, a penalty for committing a crime, have a clean record, have a job, speak English, have to fulfill all those conditions. But the idea of rounding people up and sending them back home, most Americans recognize as cruel and impractical.
Mm-hmm. Let's take up this issue of communication. I was interested in your involvement with Third Way. We talked about that last week in the midst of the horrors in Tucson. I hear this morning that there will be at least a couple senators. I wonder how many. Symbolic this is, but nonetheless, a step in the right direction. We'll break the State of the Union tradition of sitting on different sides of the chamber.
That's right. The idea really came from our think tank, Third Way. Was picked up by a number of legislators, including Mark Udall, the senator from Colorado. And it looks like a number of senators and members of Congress are going to sit mixed with colleagues from the other side so that the State of the Union doesn't degenerate into what it really had become, which was a pep rally for the president's party and an opposition rally for the president's for the opposition party. And it was a bit of an embarrassing spectacle to see half the audience rise and cheer and the other half sit there sullenly with their arms crossed. This will be not a huge substantive step, but it'll be a bit of a breakthrough. And, of course, sadly, the momentum for this was created by the Tucson tragedy.
Mm-hmm. And does that momentum carry over, do you think, into discussions this week about repealing health care reform and all the other contentious issues?
I think the House will vote to repeal health care reform because that was a very strong pledge made by Republicans if they took over the House. The Speaker recognizes it. He wants to put it very high on the agenda. It won't really mean a great deal unless vast numbers of Democrats join the Republicans. I doubt that they will. and it certainly won't get anywhere in the Senate, and the president won't sign it. And if he does veto it, it will not. The veto cannot be overridden by the House and Senate. What people are going to be looking for in the House vote is it'll get a majority, won't go very far, but will it get anything close to the two-thirds that would be necessary to override a presidential veto? I seriously doubt it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that everybody in Washington is still having difficulty figuring out what you can say now, how passionately you can say something, what's considered dangerous rhetoric, what kinds of rhetoric will just show that you're passionate about your cause?
I think that there is some sense that people want to tone it down. Mm. That was the message of the Tucson shooting. Mm-hmm. Tone it down. And frankly, that message was very strongly felt, certainly expressed by Democrats, but strongly felt among those on the right who had sometimes used intemperate rhetoric. Occasionally, the left did the same thing. But I think it happened more often on the right. And I think while they're not going to change their principles and they're still going to fulfill their mandate, which they believe is standing up to President Obama, stopping his program, undoing it as much as possible, they'll try to do it without the invective and the fiery rhetoric that we've heard often in the past.
So that will continue for quite some time, do you think, stopping using that rhetoric?
Yes. It could reach a climax very quickly in the vote on the national debt. A lot of Republicans in the House have threatened not to vote to extend the national debt, in which case that would be a showdown like the shutdown of Congress back in 1995. Essentially, it's a show of defiance, even if it means cutting off the good faith and credit of the United States. That would create a crisis. It would embarrass the United States. I'm not sure that the dollar would collapse or our economic position would simply disappear. We're too strong a country for that. But it would be, at the very least, an embarrassment. And I think, as happened in the 90s, the Republicans would be held responsible for this act of defiance that had no real meaning to most people.
What would happen, Bill? Would the government shut down?
It might. That could very well happen. The real concern is that the bond markets, the credit rating of the United States would collapse, and bond markets, people would no longer buy United States bonds because we've shown we're not credit worthy. I honestly don't think anything like that will happen. The economy here is too big. I don't think it'll happen, but there'll be a huge round of criticism, and the country will be, shall we say, at least embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
And we could have a shutdown of the federal government again.
And if we so what people are dealing with is whether or not we're going to take care of the debt by cutting spending significantly. And there hasn't been a wide ranging discussion about that because the programs that cost the most money, most people don't want to cut. Right.
That's right. Entitlements. That's the core of the problem. Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid. Nobody wants to cut those programs. Republicans have talked about reorganizing them on a different principle, essentially giving vouchers to people instead of Medicare benefits so that they get an amount of money that they can spend as they wish. But it's going to be very difficult to get anything like that passed. It wouldn't happen to current Medicare recipients, only to those somewhere in the future, probably people below 50. But the fact is, they have come up. We had a deficit commission that gave a report, and the report was breathtaking in its proposals. Some new taxes, but about twice as large spending cuts, really cutting at the heart of what the federal government has done. That kind of thing will be difficult, maybe impossible to do. There is only one way, historically, that we know how to get out of a recession. Which is economic growth. That's what happened in the 90s. We got into this fix in the 1990s. You know, every time, or not every time, but often when we have a Republican president, Reagan did this, Bush, the son, did this, they cut taxes, they increase defense spending, the deficit soars, and then there's a 10 or 15-year debate over how to deal with it. Well, in the 90s, we dealt with it by the miracle of economic growth. That's certainly, the deficit is too deep right now for us to grow out of it. But it would solve a lot of the problem if the economic recovery took hold. And frankly, it's endangered a bit right now if the federal government and the state governments undertake aggressive austerity plans and cut spending too much.
Mm-hmm. So how do we grow the economy?
Oh, that's a good one. Obviously, people have to start spending money, and they are doing that. There has to be a surge of confidence. But the basic problem is housing. And that's going to be a core problem for some time. The question is, will the housing market recover? That was at the core of the financial collapse of 2008. That's still the core of the problem today. And while consumer spending has gone up a bit, there's some signs of recovery. Nothing really is going to be done to turn the economy around until housing values increase. That's bound to happen eventually because there's just so much pent-up demand. People want to move. The country is growing. People are going to want new housing. But it may take some time.
Mm-hmm. And what about jobs? What about getting people back to work? What is it, a new economy that we need, a green economy? What will lower that very high rate?
Well, a lot of people believe that trade has a strong potential. Most Americans see trade as a job-killing issue, that jobs go overseas where people can be paid less. But very often trade creates jobs, not the same jobs, and not often, sadly, for the same people. People who are thrown out of work because they have certain lower skills that can be done by people overseas will find it very hard to get a new job. That is, unfortunately, the way the economy works. But when we have a thriving trade and we can sell to markets like China with over a billion people, if that market opens up more than it has to goods and services from the United States, that could be a whole new market that could create a lot of American jobs. But they may well be different jobs for different people than the ones who are losing their jobs.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about the beginning of a recovery that we're seeing now, what policies have been in place that would be creating that, or is it just sort of a natural phenomena?
Well, certainly the economic stimulus had some impact. I wouldn't say it should be credited with all the good things that have happened, but it did end the recession. Technically, we've been out of recession for over a year now. The growth has been extremely sluggish, and this is an unusual recession because it's taken longer than after typical recessions to get unemployment down. So, you know, the stimulus had something to do with it. A lot of economists argue that the stimulus wasn't nearly big enough to get the economy moving, and they're very worried about new rounds of austerity, particularly in state governments. You've probably heard Scott Walker in your state of Wisconsin talk about the need for a new austerity. That is happening all over the country right now. If there is retrenchment by the states laying off teachers and firefighters and police and prison guards, and some prisoners have been released, then that could just nip the economic recovery right in the butt.
Mm-hmm. What about the state of Illinois and the increase in taxes in that state?
That kind of takes your breath away.
Two-thirds
increase in the tax rate. Well, that's certainly one way of doing it. That's not the way most voters want. But in Illinois and a number of other states, the governors and legislatures have just reached their wit's end in terms of what they can possibly do. California, the new governor, who is also the former governor, been out of office for 28 years, Jerry Brown, says that he would support a tax increase only if the voters approved of it. And he's having trouble getting it on the ballot right now. But in most states, some kind of tax increase, possibly disguised as fee increases or something, they may be in the cards. The point is, all that takes money out of the economy, and it could be very dangerous. Austerity could be very dangerous right now. In the end, it's going to be necessary. We have to deal with the debt. We have to deal with the deficit. But the question is, do you want to do it in a big way and so quickly?
Bill Schneider is our guest for All Things Political today. We're welcoming phone calls for him at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. He's been CNN's senior political analyst since 1990. He's also a distinguished senior fellow and resident scholar at Third Way, and he's a professor of public policy at George Mason University. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. Tomorrow during our 10 o'clock hour, Ron Reagan will be joining us. He is author of My Father at 100, which is really quite a lovely book about the relationship with his father. And he goes back to Illinois to where his father had his formative years as a child. The book has made a lot of news over the weekend because of the question whether or not he had Alzheimer's when he was in office. But it's a small part of this book that is They didn't always see eye to eye about a lot of issues, but he loved his father, of course, and it has a warmth and a beauty about it that I think you'll enjoy. So that's Ron Regan tomorrow at 10. Let's go to phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Bill Schneider, Fort Atkinson. Caller Richard is first. Hi, Richard.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I would like to make the Martin Luther King observation that the Martin Luther King, which is celebrated all over the country today, is not the Martin Luther King that died. He was the Martin Luther King of pre-1967 Riverside speech in New York, in which he bitterly criticized government policy in the Vietnam War. And then, of course, later on that year, he took on the garbage workers' strike in Memphis, Tennessee. And both of those things were very unpopular with the establishment, including the New York Times. And it's something that we all conveniently forget when we celebrate his work against segregation. But it leads into a question that I have for your guest. Could he give us a capsule review of Andrew Bacevich's book, Washington Rules, which describes exactly what King was opposed to, and that is American military domination over the entire world?
I'm not sure that Bill's even read that. You're asking an awful lot of him to do this. But what about King's radicalism, Bill?
Well, towards the end of his career, as the caller indicated, he turned to a bigger agenda.
Mm-hmm.
He became a critic of the Vietnam War, and which a lot of Democrats had already begun to before him. He didn't lose focus on civil rights, of course. That was his signature legacy, which I do think is what we celebrate in the country or commemorate in Martin Luther King's birthday. But he did turn his attention to other issues and broaden his agenda quite a bit. You've got to remember, and I was around in those days, I can remember that there was a lot of pressure on Dr. King from more radical, more outspoken leaders in the African-American community, Rap Brown and Stokely Carmichael, people who had a lot of appeal to younger African-Americans, who considered just the call for desegregation too limited, that a lot more needed to be done. And I think Dr. King felt that pressure. But the signature achievement of Dr. King is that he led the fight to remove the stain and the stigma of segregation that had lasted in this country ever since the writing of the writing of the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. I'm always struck by the fact that all of this horrible era of segregation and lynchings and was not that long ago, Bill. You talk about growing up in the South, and I worked in the South many years ago. It's something that we still struggle with, but we have made some progress. But it's in our very recent past, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I teach classes, as you indicated, at George Mason University, and I tell students, when I was growing up, I went to an all-white school. I didn't know many African Americans. They lived around the corner on the side streets. When I explained to students that when we took the ferry across the river, whites had to sit on one side and what were then called colored had to sit on the other side. There were white movie theaters and colored movie theaters. Mm-hmm. If I wanted to see a film playing at a colored movie theater, I couldn't sit in the audience. I had to sit in the projectionist booth. It was incredible. When you went to a doctor's office, whites sat on one side in a different waiting room and got served first. Colored sat on the other side and got served at the end of the day. You know what students' reaction is? That's ridiculous. You're making it all up. That could never
really
have happened. It's so unbelievable to people today, yet it is within my memory and the memory of many, many other people, which is why on election night 2008, I said, along, I think, with millions of other Americans, I never thought I would see the day.
Mm-hmm. No, I didn't either. Thank you, Richard, for your call. We go to Mike from Appleton. Hi.
Kind of going back to the economy, your guest had a point there about trade and there's this very large group of people who are probably 50 years old and plus who are unemployed, who have lost those jobs, which are not coming back. And while yes, the economy will tend to start to grow and new jobs will be created. You know, they're not for them. So what happens to that group of people who are probably in the tens of millions? I mean, potentially that's a problem as bad as a housing problem.
It is a very serious problem because it's very hard to retrain people who have been in a career and they're over 50. A lot of them are going to find themselves thrown on the mercy of relatives. They're going to have to find part-time, lower-paying jobs that can enable them to get along until they're eligible for retirement. That's a very sad story. But the creation of new jobs often means that those jobs don't go to the people, particularly the older people who have been thrown out of work. Essentially, that's what government is all about. That's what the idea of the safety net is all about. The safety net is supposed to be there from state and local and federal governments. It's supposed to be there to help precisely those people. Sometimes there are re-education, retraining programs, adult education that can give them new skills. But that's what the government safety net is all about. And right now, that safety net is being threatened by the realm of austerity that's taking place all over the country.
We go to Linda next in La Crosse. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I'm sorry. I was wanting to call about one thing, but then I heard Richard on the phone talking about Martin Luther King. And I'd like to comment that in that Riverside speech, Martin Luther King said the United States was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. And he said, until we stopped spending more on militarism than on the needs of the citizens of this country, we would be approaching spiritual death. And I believe in the last 50 years, that's what we're experiencing. I'd like to comment that since he died, we've bombed Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, Guatemala, Grenada, Libya, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Panama, Sudan, Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, and Iraq. I think we're missing a giant opportunity to address the problems of this country by not paying attention to that Riverside speech.
Bill.
Well, that's a point a lot of Americans agree with, and there has been a disillusionment with American military power since we've had two wars that were deeply controversial, the Vietnam War that, frankly, when I was young, I thought it would go on forever. And then, of course, the war in Iraq, where we made many of the same mistakes, nation-building, the view that we could solve another country's political problems militarily by using force. There is a disillusionment with the ubiquity, with the omnipotence of the United States in the world and our ability to shape the world. But one fact remains. A lot of those interventions, you know, are controversial. Some are not. Remember, we were attacked on 9/11, and that had a lot to do with the original war in Afghanistan. But the fact remains that, as Madeleine Albright once said, the United States is the world's essential power. If the United States doesn't act, nothing will happen. Nothing would have happened in Bosnia, where they had the terrible ordeal of ethnic cleansing. We left it to the Europeans for about 8 years, and they couldn't do anything until we stepped in and put an end to it. Saddam Hussein would still be in Kuwait, and God knows where else he would be if the United States had not acted way back in 1990. That was the first Gulf War to push him out of Kuwait. We have discovered that as a responsibility of the United States. If the United States doesn't do anything, nothing will happen, and many of the world's most outrageous problems will not be solved. That was certainly the lesson we learned with the genocide in Rwanda. We didn't do anything, and hundreds of thousands of people were massacred.
Let's spend a little more time on Afghanistan. We have been there for years and years now, Bill. Many ask, why haven't we been able to see some significant progress? How long does it take, and why haven't we seen much progress?
Well, sometimes it can take 1,000 years. Alexander the Great was in Afghanistan. The British, the Russians, now the United States. It's very hard for us to, well, build a nation. You know, when George Bush was running for president back in 2000, he made fun of nation building. He said that shouldn't be what American military is used for. And most Americans agreed then, and they agree now. The military should be used for military purposes, to win victories. It's very hard for us to reorder another nation, whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq. What we're trying to do now, obviously, is create some stability there, and to get our troops out, as President Obama has promised. People understand what Afghanistan was about back in 2001. We invaded a few weeks after 9/11. We overthrew the Taliban. We got out, that is, the war was completed. In December, we won. And for the next 5 years, the only issue, the big issue internationally, was Iraq, Iraq, Iraq. Then when President Obama became president, we went back to the war in Afghanistan, which he had always described as more or less the good war, the war that was justified. And what we discovered was it had gotten no easier. In fact, it had gotten a lot harder.
Thanks, Linda, for your call. Bob in Marshfield is next. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. It impresses me, and the conservatives are supposed to be business people, that we are at a 10% deficit to Europe in terms of cost percentage of GDP that it costs for health care. I don't know what our military costs, what percentage of GDP that is, but when we start that far behind, it seems impossible to me to compete our way out of this recession.
Well, that's a good point, and the government is trying to do something about it. They passed health care reform. I mean, people are aware of those figures, which are shocking. We spend much more on health care than other industrial countries, and we get less for it. There's no indication Americans are healthier. In fact, they may be less healthy than people in other countries, even though we spend a lot more money. It's spent wastefully and inefficiently. That was the main problem, or one of the main problems, along uncovered by insurance, that health care reform was supposed to deal with. But of course, now that program is under threat. I don't think it'll be repealed by a vote of the whole of Congress. The House will vote to repeal it. Don't think the Senate will. But, you know, it's facing a very serious test in the courts. The courts may decide that health care reform and the individual mandate forcing people to buy something, health insurance, is unconstitutional, in which case we're going to have to go back to the drawing board. But the problem is a real one. And, you know, healthcare reform was one way of trying to deal with it. The military costs, of course, another. The United States spends a lot more on military than the entirety of the continent of Europe because we have such a great responsibility we've assumed in the world, the leader of the free world, in a way, the policeman to the world, even though Americans are not happy with that role. So it's a burden that we have and that we have to figure out how to pay for.
Anything else, Bob?
No, it just seems ridiculous to me.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Bill Schneider is our guest for all things political today. He's a political analyst, senior political analyst for CNN. And we go next to Daryl from Exonia. Hi, Daryl.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wonder what his comments would be on that, what went on in Tanzania. And from what I saw in the news where they said that basically it was because people were angry and they were Twittering and they read what was on Wikipedia about how the president was living lavishly and his brother had all, you know, they were extorting money from the country. And then you guys on public radio had somebody from the country on Friday, and he said, well, you know, the president was really in touch with people over 30, but everybody under 25 he knew nothing about, and that's who rose up and was angry and threw him out of office. And then on the news they said, well, this is, the Arabs are afraid. Well, this could spread across the Arab world. And I was thinking, yeah, angry young people. I think in America, when everybody, these young people turn off their video games and go outside and look around and say, hey, you know, what's happening around here? They're going to be angry. And even like that guy that shot people in Arizona, they had his friend on the news, and he said, well, he wasn't shooting at people. He was shooting at the world. And I think, you know, what are your comments on this, just the anger that's around of young people that feel like, hey, you've mortgaged our future. They're people are angry. And I was just wondering, you know, that not only is it going to go across the Arab world, I think that repercussions of what's happening in the world are going to go across the entire world.
Well, I wouldn't rush to equate what's happening in Tunisia with what's happening in the United States. They're very, very different. There is a message from Tunisia to the entire Arab world. It's got governments like Egypt and Lebanon and Syria and governments all across the Middle East very, very scared, really. Because many of them are led by repressive, undemocratic regimes. There are very few functioning democracies in the Middle East. Israel is one. Turkey is another. But in Arab countries, there are very, very few. Turkey is not an Arab country. And some of those regimes, Saudi Arabia, they buy people off, of course, because they have so much oil money. But the fact is they're not democratic at all. And the United States Secretary Clinton has warned that some of these encrusted, long-serving regimes have to deal with a restive class of people. A lot of them are young, very well-educated. They can't get good jobs. A lot of them resent the lack of democracy and freedom in their countries. Egypt has been in turmoil for some time. They just had a massacre of Christians in Egypt. The tensions are there. They're there in Lebanon. And there is a danger that what happened in Tunisia, this restive class of young people, could spread around the world. There's a huge cadre of younger people in Saudi Arabia. If Saudi Arabia were really a democracy, goodness knows what kind of government they would elect, because there has been so much pent up frustration for so long.
Hmm. Thanks, Gerald, so much for your call. We go to Sandy in Algoma next. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Kathleen. You know what? I'm so angry right now. I can't even see straight. I'm listening to this guy, your guest. The CNN is so entrenched with the rest of the mainstream media and censoring what we get. Everybody out there needs to go and get the book from the library called Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, and they will find out exactly what's been going on in this country. The multinational corporations are joined at the hip with the government, with the United States government, namely the CIA and the World Bank, and they go into these third world countries, and they basically trick them into signing a contract so that it lets these multinational corporations provide infrastructure projects, knowing that it's going to put them into debt that they will never be able to pay back. And when they cannot pay it back, and they count on this happening, that they will then be able to force them into either signing over their public utilities, calling in the name of privatizing the public utilities, or they take over their natural resources by their mining or oil, and in the meantime, they completely put the entire country into poverty because they're trying so hard to pay back that debt. And that is what's causing the poverty. That's what's causing the conflict around the world. And we are at the heart of it. We're not solving anything.
Bill.
Well, I haven't read that particular book.
I haven't either.
I know that the grievance that the caller expresses is felt by a number of people. I don't know the facts of the matter. I just simply can't comment on that. But I do know that we've had a democratization of the media. She mentioned CNN. I'm now a consultant to CNN, and I appear on CNN International. But I was at CNN Domestic for about 20 years. I can assure you there's no censorship of information, and there's plenty of information out there on the Internet. There's been a real democratization of media and of voices in this country. Sometimes it can be unpleasant. Sometimes it's very productive. But that's one of the big changes we've seen in recent years, and certainly in my lifetime, that people talk back to the media in ways that they really didn't back in the 50s and earlier than that. That's, for the most part, healthy. Some people question it. Do we need to know everything that was released in the WikiLeaks documents and may yet be released? But it's a very, very significant change in the way the media work in this country.
And what about a lot of the conversation last week was about the media being in a certain camp, much as members of Congress have been, and having to have a certain kind of rhetoric and appeal to a base of people who expect a certain kind of analysis of what's going on, and thus we just reinforce this separation that we were talking about at the beginning of this hour, and it's a source of people making money in the media and really a source of let's divide people further. Do you worry about that?
It is a concern, but it's nothing new. If you look back in American history, we had partisan media a long time. Go back to the days of Andrew Jackson, and even before that to Thomas Jefferson. You discover newspapers were harsh and shrill and partisan. Many historians say they were responsible. Sensational journalism was responsible for the Spanish-American War. Remember the Maine. There was a lot of shrill journalism in the past. That kind of disappeared for a while after World War II, when television and one newspaper towns led the media to believe that they served a mass audience and had to give careful balance and attention to all sides. Then what happened really in the 90s was that Fox Television discovered that there was a market for people who want their news delivered from a particular point of view. They don't want to know just what happened. They want to know, what do Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly and Glenn Beck think about what happened?
Mm-hmm.
That audience is there. and it will be served. This is a very entrepreneurial country. Where there is a market, there will be a product. And Fox News found out how to market to that product. And MSNBC has done the same thing with viewers on the left who also want their news from a point of view. And for a lot of young people, Jon Stewart is their principal news source because he presents news from a somewhat skeptical and sarcastic point of view, but he's very effective in that. There is an audience for people who want careful, balanced information, who just want to know what's going on. Unfortunately, it's not a mass audience. My view is all these voices should be heard. Some of them are irresponsible, but the voices should all be heard. This is democracy. We have freedom of speech.
Bill Schneider, our guest this hour, and we're doing all things political, which we always do, Mondays at 9. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our lines have been crowded. You can always use the email thing here, too. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program this Monday, we'll be talking about end-of-life care. We'll have two guests with us, a professor in the School of Social Work from UW-Madison and also a professor of medicine, healthcare policy, and research at the University of Colorado. Bill Schneider is with us now for All Things Political, leading U.S. political analyst. He is CNN's senior political analyst. He's also a contributing editor to National Journal, The Atlantic Monthly. He's a distinguished senior fellow and resident scholar at Third Way, and we're happy to have him for our discussion of politics this hour. Let's go to Ray in Milwaukee next. Hi, Ray.
Good morning, Kathleen, and your guest. Thanks for letting me ask this question. This is Martin Luther King's birthday, and this morning Charlene Huntergault was on an earlier program, and she brought up an incident where Martin Luther King was put into a police van and driven from one city to the next with a snarling, vicious dog in the back of the van with him. And as soon as she described that, I thought to myself, now where have I heard something like this before? And it reminded me of Iraq and Afghanistan and snarling dogs used to torture people. Now, I wanted to ask Charlene Huntergault if we have actually gone backwards on the issue of human rights and what Martin Luther King really strongly stood up for was rights of all people. And at the end of his life, he was also against the Vietnam War, which caused a split between him and other civil rights leaders. And I just wanted to ask Charlene, did she think we had gone backwards in our treatment of people, especially prisoners? And even now, the U.S. government keeps a base in Afghanistan off limits to U.S. laws. And I'll take your answer off
the air. All right.
Thanks.
Bill.
Well, I'm not Charlene Huntergault.
Right, it's Bill Schneider.
But I can give you my answer, which is I do not think we've gone backwards. I think we have made progress. Have all these problems been solved? Absolutely not. There are still injustices. There are still outrages. We discovered the behavior of American troops in Abu Ghraib, which was totally unacceptable. It helped bring an end to the Iraq War because so many people were, or at least American involvement in Iraq, because so many American people were outraged by that. Remember what happened in 2006 when the Republican Congress was thrown out. I don't think we've gone backwards, but we haven't solved all these problems. There are still serious, grave injustices. But when you think about the days 100 years ago of lynching, when thousands of people were killed in the South and border states every year because of people taking justice in their own hands, taking the criminal system in their own hands, that was an outrage that Congress found had a lot of trouble dealing with. We have made a lot of progress since those days.
And thanks very much for your call. I want to spend a little bit of time on Third Way and Congresswoman Giffords, who you must know from your work in the media and also from your work at Third Way.
Yes, what is the question?
She, this whole incident just stays with us so deeply, and I'm wondering about this moderating voice that she represents in this country and a moderating voice that Third Way represents. Do you see a kind of a large mass movement for people demanding that and maybe even a political party arising because of that demand?
Devoutly to be wished. I don't see a mass movement yet, but I see some indications that people are becoming exasperated. We have had a cultural civil war in this country for almost 50 years. It started in the 1960s. I always point out that in the 1960s, the Chinese had a great proletarian cultural revolution. They got over it. In the 1960s, the United States had a great American cultural revolution, but we're still fighting it. We're still fighting the battles of the 60s over issues like gay rights and race and abortion and all kinds of things that simply cannot get settled. They become institutionalized in the division between the parties. What will it take to end that division, that polarization? Well, I once said maybe it'll take a terrible national trauma. We had one, 9/11, and the country was united for exactly 1 year, when most Democrats actually supported President Bush, but it all ended with the Iraq War. Maybe it will take a charismatic leader, a heroic figure. Well, the last four presidents of the United States were all elected on a pledge to unite the country. The first President Bush talked about a kinder, gentler America. President Clinton was a new Democrat, and he was, by his own definition, the third way. President Bush, when he first ran for president, I was there in Austin, Texas. He said, "I'm a uniter, not a divider." Well, he wasn't. And, of course, President Obama first came into public prominence by saying there's no red America or blue America, there's the United States of America. And in a way, all of those presidents failed. It will take a real mass movement the way you're describing it. We're seeing inklings of it now. The third way is trying to encourage that. But it's going to take some work and some building.
Mm-hmm. Paul is next in Duluth. Hi, Paul.
Oh, hi. Good morning, Kathleen and Bill. Bill, I haven't seen you on the air a lot recently. I've got an international question for you. I just heard that baby Doc Duvalier has returned to Haiti, and they just had a disputed election a year after the earthquake. I don't know what to make of that, and I want to listen off the air. You got a clue what's up with this guy?
I'm amazed to hear that he's still alive and functioning. I did not hear that he'd gone back to Haiti. Haiti, of course, is a terrible, terrible situation, tragic in every sense of the word. The earthquake just took a country with immense problems and made them infinitely worse. And what his intentions are of going back from going back to Haiti, I simply don't know. Haiti is a very poor, really an hemisphere. The United States, I think, has done a great deal to try to help. President Clinton has taken on a special responsibility for Haiti. A lot of Haitian refugees have come to Florida. Many of them, it's interesting, many of those refugees are well-educated, they're professional people, and they've done very, very well in the United States. It's not for lack of human talent. The Haitian people are extremely cultured and often well-educated and artistic and talented. But the system in Haiti is just not working at all and hasn't for decades.
Oh, life is just unfair, isn't it? I frequently think about how hard it would be if we happened to be born somewhere else or be born that poor, be born where all these horrible natural disasters take place again and again. It's hard to figure out all of that, isn't it, Bill?
It is indeed. And it says something about the United States, that people from a country as poor as Haiti, where there are terrible tropical diseases, they don't speak English, of course, they speak Creole, they're poor, they come to the United States, and they do very well here. They do very well here, which says something about the blessings of the American system, that people who have that kind of talent and ambition can succeed, even when the economy is not particularly good.
Yes. Let's go to Brad next. And we have a couple lines open for the first time. Our number is 800-486-8655. Brad is next. Hi, Brad.
Hi there. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
One thing that I found disturbing over the last several years is a sort of false equivalency that the alphabet networks, if you will, CNN, ABC, CBS, are trying to establish between the left and the right, almost in an effort to appease the right wing, which routinely accuses them of being left wing. And, they'll say for every right wing critique, the media feels a need to then say, oh, well, the left is just as bad. And I feel that that's not accurate. I feel that that's not fair. I feel like the orders of magnitude are vastly different between the right and the left. I feel like most of the lies, distortions, and violent rhetoric are coming from the right. But if you listen to a network like CNN, they posit it as though both sides are equal and it's a wash. I think that's unfair. And also, the voices that you do have on the left, their audience is much smaller. Fox News, that you mentioned earlier, one of the reasons they're so popular is because the first 5 years of their existence, they're actually losing money. It's just that Rupert Murdoch was pumping so much money into it to keep it afloat and to get the message across. And I'd like you to comment on that false equivalency.
It is a problem with the press that you know, they believe if one side is heard, the other side should be given equal time and attention and legitimacy. That's the way the media work. If a network were to put on a spokesman from one side, if it's considered a balanced network, then they feel an obligation to put the other side on. That can work. That can be very detrimental. Does that mean that if you have a person talking about the horrors of the Holocaust, you have to have a Holocaust denier on? Does that mean if you have someone who talks about Martin Luther King's legacy, you have to have someone on who's a racist? Of course not. And that is a false equivalency. In the case of left and right, here's one inequivalency. There are twice as many conservatives in the country as there are liberals. That's simply a fact. You can see it in any poll. About 20% of Americans call themselves liberal. About 40% call themselves conservative. They're obviously not equivalent. Does that mean conservatives should get twice as much attention as liberals? No, of course. You know, you want to give both sides at least their due and try to give them equal cogency in their arguments. This is a question of news judgment. It isn't always exercised perfectly. But there's a real problem of when do you treat different views as equivalent. I think today the politics of anger and resentment has been captured by the Tea Party movement, angry at President Obama, the Democrats in Congress, Washington. While you certainly can find examples of incendiary rhetoric on both the left and the right, and it was certainly there on the left in 2006 over the Iraq War, and you know, some earlier over the Vietnam War. Right now, the politics of anger is mostly on the right, and I think that is one reason why the response to Tucson made the right very, very defensive, because in their view, when people were demanding civility in government, many on the right thought it was an attack on them and treated it that way. I think they did not benefit from that reaction.
Yes, I think you're right. What is it about us, though, that make, you mentioned this earlier, that we tune in to find out what Sean Hannity is thinking or what Keith Olbermann is thinking, and then what they say, it's almost as though they've got the Republican or Democratic talking points and the same language gets filtered into political discussion across the board. Why is it that we want to have our ideas framed by one person? Who cares who that person is? Why are they so important?
A lot of Americans identify with public figures. They always have, whether it's a political leader, and these days a broadcaster. It can be a fiery person who's angry, or it can be a very thoughtful person. It can be a Jon Stewart, for goodness sake. A lot of young people identify with his point of view. That's a natural tendency. We want to find people who think the way we do, and that reinforces our opinions and sometimes our prejudices. It's not a very open-minded way of thinking, but it's a natural human tendency. There is a constituency, as I said, who want their information reasonable, balanced. They want to hear from both sides. That is not the mass audience in this country or any other country, sadly. That is, you know, an audience of well-educated, thoughtful people who are always going to be in the minority, unfortunately.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's always the same people, too, the same guests, the same everything, when there are so many very, very smart, caring people all over the country and the world, for that matter.
Well, you remember this. The media is a business. And as a business, they've got to make money. To make money, they've got to find an audience. And so they find often the easiest way to get an audience is to be more shrill, more outspoken. There's a built-in market for that, whether it's on the right and smaller, but there on the left, or whether it's an audience for satirical presentation. Those audiences are there. And as I said, The United States is a capitalist society where there's a market, there will be a product. The market is there for that kind of news and information. I don't resent the fact that it's served. I just don't think it should crowd out thoughtful, balanced,
right,
and reasoned information.
Yeah, I'm with you. Thank you, Bill, so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Bill Schneider, leading U.S. political analyst, our guest this hour. He has been CNN's senior political analyst since 1990. He is also distinguished senior fellow and resident scholar at Third Way, and he's a professor of public policy at George Mason University. His CNN political team awarded an Emmy for their 2006 election coverage and a Peabody for their 2008 election coverage. That's it for our first hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour, Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in snowy downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and we'll return with another hour of Monday conversation looking at end-of-life issues. Tomorrow during the 10 o'clock hour, Ron Reagan is our guest. This is the Ideas Network.